You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, September 2nd, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, John Bemelman's Marciano on whatever happened to the metric system. How America kept its feet. Also on the program today, Eric Cantor, of course. Do I need to say more? You could fill in the blank. It involves his job, his new job. Meanwhile, Thursday, we'll see new fast food strikes around the country. And with exactly, well, I guess how you measure it, 6 days until the New York State primary, the question is, will Cuomo end up having to dump his lieutenant nominee, Kathy Hochul, from the ticket? Also, for those of you concerned about the midterms, there is one guy out there claiming the Democrats have a better chance of maintaining the Senate than losing it. Israel annexes another 1,000 acres in the West Bank. That'll help. And CeeLo Green, the crooner, apparently back on Twitter after having deleted some heinous tweets now that he pled no contest, dropping a roofie in a woman's drink. And it's back to school, or to school for the first time, for 50,000 preschool students in New York City. All that and more on today's program. Pretty excited to have John Marciano on to talk about the metric system. My interest was piqued after reading Rick Perlstein's book about the ascendancy of Reagan, or I guess the transition from the Nixon era to the Reagan era. We will get to that in a moment. Just a couple of quick hits. You'll recall President Obama had said that upon returning from summer, he would have an executive order regarding immigration. It now appears that may not come until after Election Day. And meanwhile, an immigration court has ruled that women who are victims of domestic violence can qualify for asylum status. In Ferguson, 50 Ferguson cops have been donated and have begun to wear body cameras starting this past weekend. And in Pennsylvania, following numerous lawsuits, the state government has revealed that 243 drinking water wells were contaminated by the fracking boom. If you have listened to this program for any period of time, you already knew that to be the case from our numerous conversations we've had with Josh Fox regarding both his films on fracking. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, John Bemelman's Marciano will be joining us. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. On the phone, John Marciano, author of Whatever Happened to the Metric System, How America Kept Its Feet. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Sam.
This is a great story, and you know, we started asking about this in the context of talking to Rick Perlstein about his latest book, which covered mostly the first half of the 70s, and this question of the metric system came up. I mean, I think we're of similar age. I may be a little bit older than you, but I couldn't shake this notion of it was almost like the metric system, the adoption of the metric system was just sort of this long-lost dream that I had gone through. But I recall specifically in elementary school, towards the end of it, this notion that the metric system was going to happen. Give us a sense of, let's go back and just start with, where was the metric system born?
Well, the metric system was actually born during the French Revolution in the 1790s. It was one of these Enlightenment ideas that was actually really met its first manifestation in the U.S. dollar. People like Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton were big proponents of decimalizing measures. And one of the things that was most surprising to me is that the U.S. dollar was actually the first decimalized measure that a government ever put into use.
And go ahead.
Yeah, no, and I was just going to say, and then the metric system actually, it disappeared with so many other revolutionary ideals, only to be reborn in the future revolutions that gripped Europe in the 1830s and 40s. And that was really when the metric system started to take hold in Europe, and there was actually a long, America actually had a long flirtation, really from the end of the Civil War right up until the Depression with going metric.
So when we get back to like the following the Civil War, what was the impetus purely just so that we could be on the same standard as the rest of the world?
Well, you know, it really depends on who was pushing it. I mean, certainly you cannot separate the metric system from globalization and from capitalism. I mean, it made it easier to buy and sell things across borders, which was a much bigger issue in Europe. I mean, already, you know, even now, of course, Europe has so many states, but then something like Germany, which wasn't formed yet, what was Germany was around 40 states. And they had different measures, and it was very difficult for them to just, you know, trade with their neighbors. So that was really the push. But then there was another side that saw it as progress. And the people in America who were really pushing for it saw it as, you know, part and parcel of science and of progress.
And now we're one of only three nations in the world that haven't adopted the metric system. What are the other countries that haven't done so?
Well, that's, you know, it's funny. It's one of those things that that's one of the things that's going around the internet. Usually it's America, Myanmar, and Liberia. There's also about five other countries, mostly small Polynesian nations, but Myanmar is probably the least metric, but is also taking steps to go metric. The thing I would say, though, is we are really, whether we know it or not, we are mostly a metric country. It's really, the metric system has, since the 70s, become our operating system, and the customary measures are really just the interface of how, you know, we deal on an everyday level with measurement.
I mean, tease that out a little bit. I mean, I know that you made that argument at the end of towards the end of the book quite a bit, and my experience in trying to customize an IKEA kitchen cabinets is has put lie to that, I think, to a certain extent. I mean, it's
metrics. I think it's one of those. Well, that's definitely true. Where I think, you know, where I think it's our, I mean, that's still you putting together the cabinetry. I mean, it's maybe another issue of, you know, how much America is becoming, you know, DIYers. The fact is that we, you know, something like we go to the doctor and we get weighed and measured and we're told it in feet and in pounds, whereas the nurse enters it in and it goes into our records as kilograms and meters. And we're driving our car, it's telling us miles per hour, but in fact, everything about the system of the car is dealing not only metrically, but it's all been made in metric parts. So I think some of it is just how you conceive of it. But certainly metric products are making inroads. I mean, you don't have to go any further than our, you know, than the beverage aisle of the supermarket to see liters everywhere.
So retell us, I mean, when was the big push in the 70s?
Well, it actually began with Sputnik, which also led to the new map. It was, you know, part of McCarthyism, of course, was just our starting to doubt ourselves, as much as it was, you know, fear of outsiders. So there was this big push in the late 50s, but we were so unfamiliar with it. I mean, the head of the House committee dealing with it said when it was brought up, he goes, "What is this metric system?" Just had no idea what it was. And so during the 60s, there were a lot of bills proposed. Finally, in the late 60s, there was the U.S., the Bureau of Standards undertook its largest research assignment ever, resulting from a congressional bill that resulted in a 1971 report that said America needed to go metric, and outlined at length why. The price put on it was very hard to tell. People were throwing out numbers like $10 billion, though a lot of people thought it was going to be north of that. In 1975, Ford signed the Metric Conversion Act, which is why people of our generation, who were then going to school afterwards, you know, grew up at that age believing that this was simply going to happen. The first couple of years was kind of smooth. Johnny Carson was on the Tonight Show introducing the country to metric measures. There were Time magazine said they started using metric measures alongside customary ones. Baseball stadiums started putting meters alongside feet on their stadium walls, and it really started to crash with the introduction of it onto highway signs, and it really had a lot of backlash when two of the major gas chains actually switched to liters per to selling by the liter rather than selling by the gallon.
What was the act that Ford signed? Was there a time frame for it? I mean, I just remember being told, and maybe I must have been around 9 or 10, that this was happening. I mean, there was no doubt about it. It was happening.
Well, the funny thing about it is that the Ford Act was more a confirmation for people. The move really started with that report that was published in 1971, and the recommendations given therein were that the country should convert within 10 years. And real conversion started to happen. Coca-Cola put out 7-Up in liter bottles instead of pint and quarts. The first metric engines started coming out in cars like the Pinto. The Chevette was an all-metric car that was made, that was American-made. California pushed the ATF to make all alcohol sales, essentially hard alcohol sales, in liters. And so there was, so that sort of put the movement forward. What was interesting was the backlash. A lot of the backlash also was orchestrated by American labor, which saw it as part of a move to make it more easy to shift jobs offshore. And there were people like also Tom Wolfe, Stuart Brand, who were kind of pushing this idea that it was, you know, it wasn't something that America needed, and that it was sort of part of a larger capitalist plot. At least Stuart Brand was. So that was, so you know, that's kind of what was happening. It was so, but Americans understood that the 1971 Act was really what was happening. So people thought by 81. We were going to convert. And it really kind of hit the shoals in around 78, 79.
It's interesting because, you know, getting back to the to Rick Perlstein's book, he describes that era as a time where the United States was sort of reckoning with its own limitations, and that in many respects, Reagan came in and propagated this idea that there was nothing American exceptionalism, and to the extent that there was any flaws in American society, it was something that was there were flaws that were being imposed upon American society. They were not coming from within, and it feels like the metric system sort of got caught up in that.
I think that that's definitely true. You almost, in some ways, you don't have to really look further than, you know, Carter got elected in 76 and Reagan in 80. I mean, it just shows what the mood, you know, what the mood of the country was. I mean, obviously very introspective in 76 and really wanting, you know, prepared to hear Reagan's message in 1980. So I think, you know, it was seen as foreign, and whereas people were looking for what we were doing wrong in the mid-70s, by the late 70s, Lord knows the early 80s, people were starting to want to say, yeah, you know, as you said, American exceptionalism, but, you know, what is all the stuff that we've done that was right? Maybe instead of changing, we need to get back to our, you know, what we do well. What I think's interesting about it is that the metric system got caught up, you know, in that perception of things, but in reality, what sent the government metric, which now every contract that the federal government puts out has to be done metric, all construction projects, that was really pushed by Reagan, Bush, and Clinton in consecutive administrations. So, you know, it's not really one of these issues that is very easy to fit into one political viewpoint or the other.
And so let's just go back and talk a little bit about like the English customary measures that are guiding, you know, what everybody uses these days, although we don't tend to use, eighths and furlongs in the way that we used to. But
yeah, no.
I mean, give us just a notion of where what we use today, where it came from, and in what was problematic about it. I mean, I know, you know, one of the stories is just that the pint in this country, your pint of beer is just, it's not what a pint would be in Britain.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm very happy to hear you say English customary measures, because most people think that we're on the British imperial measures, but those actually didn't come into existence until long after we had split from Britain. And so, yes, the imperial pint, you know, if you've ever sat down at a bar in Britain and gotten a little drunker than you thought, it was because the pint is about 4 ounces bigger there. So, yeah, I think the most confusing thing, we're talking about the most confusing thing about our measures is that we have all these different, our volume measures make almost, you know, I don't want to say they make no sense, but we have all these different standards. I mean, we have a different one for dry measures, a different one for wet measures. And when you're buying 16 ounces of ice cream, is it dry? Is it wet? Is it weight? I mean, it's very hard. It's very hard for us to tell. You know, if you want to talk about where these things came from, I mean, most of them came from either the human body, most obviously the foot. The inch was in most other languages called the thumb. And then, but even something like the acre had its origin in how much land could be plowed by a team of oxen in the morning. And most land measures around the world had some kind of variant on that.
And it's interesting, too, because the size of a meter has changed, or what it's been pegged to has changed through the years.
Yeah, well, in origin, it was supposed to be 1/40 millionth of the Earth's circumference, which was a definition that didn't last very long because it was based on a survey that was faulty. Of course, you know, better measures came along all the time. So, but then it was really based on a platinum bar, and then it was found the bar was impure, and there was a new bar made of metal, and since then there have been a couple definitions according to basically the speed of light.
And what I also found interesting about the getting back to Jefferson in the way that he was adamant about our currency being based on a decimal system was that it was getting us off sort of like a weight-based system. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Well, Jefferson actually saw it as almost a cornerstone to the to what he imagined. He actually had this plan to create a decimalized version of for literally American weights and measures, and he had wanted the dollar to be exactly an ounce, which was going to be a tenth of a pound. So he actually saw it as part of an integrated system. Really, it wasn't until it was almost a hallmark of liberalism, you know, of kind of that classical liberalism of the 19th century that coins had to be weight. It almost wasn't until Keynes that started to break apart as far as the kind of the measurement vanguard went.
And and for the life of me, I couldn't track it back down, but there's something just incredibly rational about the metric system in terms of you're being able to carry, and I think you touched on this with the notion of ounces and wet and dry and volume, but you can carry the metric system through different, I guess, not so much mediums, but I guess you can. It's rational going from size to weight to mass, et cetera. Yes.
Yeah, I mean it's extremely rational, and it is amazing that everything was integrated to the point where if you think about, so the meter was 1/40 millionth of the Earth's circumference, and then the liter was based on a certain portion of the meter that was cubed, and then weight, the kilogram, was based on a deciliter. Well, it was based in some way on a liter filled with water, and then coinage was based on the weight of the kilogram. So, you know, in essence, the franc was, if I'm remembering this right, was something like, you know, the water, like it was the weight of water in a cube that was 1/8 billionth or something, 1/9 billionth of the Earth's circumference. So it really was this kind of, it really is a perfectly rational system.
How did this play with sort of the notion? I mean, you know, I guess I grew up thinking that a foot was essentially the size of some king's foot at one point. It seems as you know, from what I've read of your piece that on one level, fractions and whatnot were considered more democratic, if you will, because it was just something that supposedly, if you didn't know math, you could still know these things. Whereas on another level, it seems that the metric system was more sort of pro-democratic, small d, in the sense that it wasn't based on some on the size of some arbitrary, you know, arbitrarily on the base of one king's foot.
Yeah, it's a very confused part of the story, because a lot of people, I mean, the oldest idea of the foot was that the oldest kind of urban legend around the foot was that it was the size of Hercules' foot, and so there was always this idea that it was somehow based on, then it became based on a king's foot. It's really, you know, it really wasn't, but it did get linked to it by a lot of people who wanted the reform, because the truth of it was that having all of these systems that are ultimately arbitrary, and to some extent the metric system is as arbitrary as any of them as far as the standards go, even though it's linked very rationally, just anything you pick as your standard is ultimately arbitrary. But to have these so many systems that were, you know, that were really held, I mean, the one thing you have to understand about what the metric system was competing against was each little kingdom and statelet and free city held onto their measures because it allowed them to tax all the goods that came through. And it was a mark of their sovereignty. It was something for them to hold on to and say, you know, we don't want to be part of a larger nation, and we don't want to belong to another king. So they took on this idea. The old measures were seen as medieval from the Middle Ages. That's within Europe. For us as Americans, or the early Americans, they were saying, look, we want to get as far away from these old, you know, these old measures of Europe. I mean, they still wanted America, of course, to be, you know, a bright, new, shining place, and they were seeing the old measures as, you know, part of backward Europe.
And just talk a little bit, I mean, just tell a couple of the stories of the nature of the, I guess, the resistance to going metric, because, I mean, it seems at one point, I think you quoted a guy from the National Cowboy Hall of Fame is saying that metrics was full-on communism.
Yeah, it was, you know, like one language, one world. I mean, it was all kind of equated as either communist or something along those lines. I mean, there was always a kind of nativist reaction against the metric system. A lot of the anti-metric stuff was from the gut, but I think it does, you know, it's something of a disservice to think of it wholly that way, because there was also a lot of artists have always been against it. One of Marcel Duchamp's famous pieces was about, I think it was like 3 meters in space, which was a criticism of that kind of rationality. Le Corbusier fully rejected the metric system. He had his own system of measurement based on man. And a lot of the people leading the 70s movement, I mean, people like Isamu Noguchi. There was an American artist named Stever Leslie, who was kind of the biggest guy against it. People like, I mean, William S. Burroughs was against it. So it was not, you know, it's hard to kind of neatly put into one place where the resistance came from. I mean, you cannot, really the biggest, most important resistance was from American labor. And I mean, they were the ones who really turned it around from the inside, from the U.S. metric board. And the other thing you have to say is there really wasn't very much support for it.
There was no natural constituency, I guess.
No, there really wasn't. I mean, outside of, you know, manufacturers, exporters, there weren't that many scientists, certainly. But, there really wasn't that mass of people who said that they wanted it.
And I mean, to what extent, I mean, obviously labor was incorrect, or at least their attempts to stop the metric system as a way of outsourcing didn't quite work out. But is there something that we lost?
Asking, so in other words, do I think that we lost something by not going metric?
Yeah, in the counterfactual world where somehow we had gone metric by 81, what would be different today?
Well, I mean, we would all be, you know, we would be measuring ourselves. I mean,
aside from all, we would all be wearing berets.
I mean, it would be a, you know, it'd be a less diverse world on the one hand. On the other hand, you know, it would be much simpler for Americans to go in other countries and drive and not. I know myself, I'm always worried about what that speed limit is because I have no idea. So, you know, I don't know, to be honest with you, that there would have been, we would have spent a lot of money in the 70s and 80s. There would have been, you know, a lot of people who weren't happy about it. I don't know that, you know, I don't know that it would have had such, it's hard to say what the effect would have been in the positive of us going metric.
And were there companies that or industries that got really caught in the, you know, entities that bought that fully bought in to the metric system? I mean, I have a couple of science projects that I know that I did as a kid that are now, you know, obsolete and mean nothing.
Yeah, sure.
But I imagine there were others who were much more heavily invested.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things where it cost. I mean, there were certain industries like pharmaceuticals. They very early on in the 20s and 30s in the U.S. started to convert to going metric, and then the car companies in the 70s. You know, but a lot of the process was them shutting down old factories and opening up new ones, and often offshore, which was, you know, the reason that the labor unions were against it. But certainly it's the people, you know, it's people who buy tools once in their lives and expect never to change them. Those would be the people who were very much against them, very much caught. You know, to look at, actually, I mean, you can look at the alternate world experience by simply going to Britain, which had a much fiercer resistance than America, but basically acquiesced because that was the price of joining the European Union. They were able to get an exception for the euro, but they had to finally go hard metric. And there was this whole metric martyr movement, people who especially sold vegetables by the old scales, and their customers came in and didn't want to buy metrically, and they were getting, you know, scales confiscated and arrests and things.
Wow. And when did that take place?
That took place right around 2000. Actually in 2000. And they would hold these protests. My favorite one was there was a protest outside of Parliament where the metric martyrs turned it into an open-air market where they only sold by customary measures. And Tony Blair had just had a child, and it was announced in the newspapers that I think she was 7 pounds, 6 ounces. And the banner outside of the market said, if it's good enough for the Blair baby, it's good enough for a Haddock.
That's funny. And yeah. All right, and I guess lastly, it's never going to happen over here, is it? We're never going to go metric.
No, I don't know. I mean, there are all these, you know, maybe we will. I mean, I think we've been going metric wherever we needed it, and now it becomes almost a personal choice. So I do think the more the world globalizes and the more, you know, kids growing up reading Wikipedia pages, once Wikipedia pages are all, you know, only in liters and meters, and people want to buy products that are coming out of South Korea, which is becoming a cultural leader, or Brazil. I mean, the sports become soccer. I mean, if in 100 years, you know, baseball is not very popular, but soccer is, I mean, that's pushing us toward becoming a more metric country. On the other hand, you know, I think we're also living in an age where, you know, things have become so compartmentalized, and there are these different interest groups of all kinds, that, you know, we live in a society that's maybe open enough to have to have all these different measures under a big tent.
Yeah, and with all that said, I will say this to folks. If you buy some IKEA cabinets, don't expect to augment them with American-made cabinets, because all the hardware is not going to it's not going to fit. It's down to metric. So that's been my biggest complaint. But John Marciano, whatever happened to the metric system, how America kept its feet, thanks so much for your time today. We'll link to that at majority.fm.
Thank you so much, Sam. Take care.
All right, folks.
Bye.
I'm going to take a break. you know, a little bit early into the funner half of the program. I don't know. That was, you know, it was a topic that I was interested in. And, you know, a lot of people say it was the death knell was Reagan disbanding that metric board. But I think it was clear that it just wasn't happening here. But I'm not convinced that the fact that we didn't adopt the metric system wasn't a function of that same mentality that when we talked about with Rick Perlstein. And I don't know. I guess I'm not so clear on that it seems to have made much of a difference. And I guess Celsius is really the only thing that we still maintain on some level, but not even, right? I guess we just can't get Canadian news, though. That's the big you can't watch Canadian weather reports and know what they're talking about. But I used to know how to convert Fahrenheit to Celsius. It was something like you multiply it and then subtract 32 or something like that. A little walk down memory lane for me. All right, coming up in the funner half of the program, we're going to talk about the strikes that are coming this Thursday. We'll be talking a lot about Cuomo, quid pro Cuomo, or Cuomo the Lesser. And it's very fun to see the concern. And frankly, you know, I've got to dig into this more, but apparently it's a very complicated situation. If Wu wins the Democratic nomination, it's quite possible you will have the Democratic Party endorsing the Cuomo. This is assuming that Cuomo wins, which may or may not be a safe assumption. I haven't seen any polling. Nobody seems to be doing any polling. But assuming Cuomo wins and Wu wins, then the Democratic Party ticket would be Cuomo-Wu, but the Working Families Party ticket, among others, would be Cuomo-Hochul. And apparently Cuomo's very concerned about this because a vote for Cuomo-Hochul on the WFP line may actually provide the WFP with the 50,000 votes that they need to qualify for the ballot next go-round. But apparently it would not count towards Cuomo's margin of victory. In which case, remember, Cuomo's number one agenda here is to win the general election with 60, 65%, 70%, I think was his dream months ago, so as to make him a national figure. If Wu wins and if Teach Out and Wu get 30% of the vote in this Democratic primary, then quid pro Cuomo is damaged goods, and he simply goes down in the history books as the not very popular Cuomo of the two, all of which would be a huge blessing, which is also not to forget that Credico may take a decent-sized chunk from Cuomo in this primary. So all very interesting to note. And there is a contrarian view of the Democrats' chances in maintaining the Senate. You know, it is now election season, folks. We got 8-9 weeks. We'll also talk about this story of CeeLo Green. I don't generally follow what, how would you classify, is he blues, rhythm, hip-hop? What is it, pop?
Yeah, it's just pop.
And he was a judge on The Voice?
Yes, he was a judge on The Voice, although he no longer is and has nothing to do with this case.
Yeah, God forbid we would mar The Voice's reputation. And As a special for Bush in Chains, we're going to talk about the 50,000 kids who are getting free preschool in New York City. And the 50,000 set of parents who now don't have to pay for either child care or worry that their kids are not getting the same leg up in entering a kindergarten as those who can afford preschool. In New York, preschool is just incredibly expensive. I mean, I imagine it is everywhere, but it is incredibly expensive. We have conversations with people all the time where this is always the biggest concern. You know, we're trying to figure out where do we... Saul is a little bit young for preschool, but we got to put him in daycare, and it's pricey. But we will get to all of that and more, and I guess a random rush for today. We'll give it another try. Last time we tuned into him, he wasn't really saying very much, and it was a little bit boring. We're going to take a break. Now we're getting all the IMs from the scientists bemoaning the fact that we don't have metrics. I'm with you. I have to look it up every time. I don't even know how many teaspoons in a tablespoon or any of that stuff. There's no rational way to figure it out. It's all by rote memory, and that's a pain in the butt. The number is 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 if you want to be a part of the program. A reminder, it is your memberships that make this show possible day in, day out. And over the Labor Day weekend, I was talking to my mother's boyfriend, who's a big fan of the show. And he's just, he may be one of the biggest Uber fans. And this guy is fairly critical of media, and he claims there is no competitor to this show. He says the only places that he knows of where you can get a 40-minute, 30-minute interview in depth with newsmakers that you hear in other places, and you hear things on this show that you do not hear other places. He says maybe Christopher Lydon's open source, but Lydon hasn't been doing political figures as much as of late. So just a reminder, if you can afford to support this show and you enjoy it on a regular basis, please do. You can also support this show if you buy crap from Amazon. Buy it through our link at majorityreportkickback.com. Click on that link, bookmark it, always buy your crap through there, and justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. We still have that... link on the site for the seeds, for their seeds initiative. This co-op of women farmers in Nicaragua, there, I believe it's in Nicaragua. The their coffee trees essentially got a fungus. Coffee.coop was working at them with them to replace the trees, but then a drought destroyed their crops, and they said, you know, we just need help eating. So please, if you can get it together for us to raise money for seeds so we can replant our crops, and we have a link to that, and we'll put it back up in today's post as well at majority.fm. All right, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be in the fun half. 646-257-3920. You can IM me at majority.fm. You can IM us through the app, majorityapp.com. We'll be right back. Satan, I will pay.